Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein again for a conversation. We have a guest who is well known to First Things readers, Professor Daniel Mahoney. Thank you for joining us, Professor Mahoney.
My pleasure.
He is a political scientist at Assumption College. Have you been Assumption your whole...
For my entire professional career,
I started
in Labor Day 1986.
Okay.
So this is my 34th academic year. The last, since 2010, I've held a chair called the Augustine Chair in Distinguished Scholarship, so I have more time for my writing, and I still teach, but just two classes a semester, which for Assumption is a blessed schedule.
That's nice. That's nice. Well, you've managed to publish a lot of things. I'll mention a couple of books. You've written two books on Alexander Solzhenitsyn. You did The Conservative Foundations of the Liberal Order a few years ago. One of your books won the Raymond Aron Prize.
That's right. I wrote a book on Aron called The Liberal Political Science of Raymond Aron. But we say Raymond Aron, shamelessly anglicizing it.
Yeah.
and that came out in several languages, and came out in the States and in France and elsewhere. And
getting a little off topic here, but is Aron still a big figure in
very
French
big.
Intellectual
there was
life?
There was just a major documentary made about him that played on Public Sénat, which is the public television station in France. And this February, there's a book called The Abécédaire de Raymond Aron, which is a group of us, maybe 40 of us, who have written on Aron, were asked to come up with our favorite quotes and sections of his books, and they've put that together as a kind of, just so the public can sort of, Aron wrote 46 books when he was alive, and another 20 were published posthumously, and he wrote columns for 30 years for Le Figaro, and for 10 years for L'Express, so there's a huge, huge corpus over 60 years.
Well,
but he was sort of the modern day, he was the representative of the Tocquevillian tradition in France, anti-totalitarian, committed to liberal democracy, but in a very sober, conservative-minded way. And at the end of his life, he was the great critic of the Soixante Huitards, the Revolution Introuvable, his work on the, is a devastating critique of the sort of spirit of nihilism that came to the forefront in 68. That's just been reissued in France. So, no, Aron is a major public presence.
That pleases me. When I was sort of getting out of my academic specialty and reading and more widely in public debate, public intellectual issues in the late 90s, early aughts, one book that was very important was The Opium of the Intellectuals that he did.
It's a great book of intellectual hygiene.
It is. That actually, there's a great opening, that opening paragraph where he talks about how, why is it that the totalitarian regimes among intellectuals in Europe, Western Europe, the totalitarian regimes sort of undergo various rationalizations and justifications, whereas the liberal democracies in the West are held to the very highest standards of paradise.
That's exactly right.
We
judge them not by concrete available alternatives, but by unreasonable standards of perfection.
Right, right.
And we don't judge, of course, the really existing socialism or the various tyrannies of the 20th century by what they do to human beings. We judge them by utopian criteria that are not relevant to the real world.
Yeah, well, we'll get it right. It might take a little time.
Well, Eric Hobsbawm, before he died, the famous English historian, was asked after the mountains, the cadavers of dead people in China and the Soviet Union, would he do it again? And he said he would do it again,
Okay, I asked the Marxist historian Eugene Genovese once how he could remain a Stalinist through the 70s, in fact, after all the evidence of the show trials and the gulag was fully verified, and he said, we believed that in order for the better world to come about, that one or two generations would have to suffer.
That's, of course,
you're going to get killing.
At least Gene had the good sense and the moral seriousness to repent in the last decades of his life.
That's right. Well, Raymond Aron. Oh, and now our topic today is another book, a book of yours that is just out. It's gotten some nice attention. You've told us about it. You did an interview with Eric Metaxas on his show and elsewhere. It's called "The Idol of Our Age: How the Religion of Humanity Subverts Christianity," and it's out with Encounter Books. For people who want it, you can go to the Encounter site. I prefer them to Amazon, but we can go to Encounter and you can order the book. But I thought that we would really just introduce the book by talking about some general terms.
Okay.
And when you say the religion of humanity, what is the religion of humanity?
Well, the religion of humanity, in the very specific sense that I talk about in the first chapter of the book, the term religion of humanity was first proffered, put forward by people like John Stuart Mill and August Comte in the 19th century. And they meant a self-conscious replacement of the horizon of human meaning and consideration from an acknowledgement of a transcendent order, a creator God, a higher spirit above human beings, to an understanding that man is the measure, man is the highest thing in the universe. Comte, who is a bit crazy, but a little précis on Comte. Comte was a positivist who believed all true knowledge was positivist. He repudiated traditional philosophy, metaphysics, and also religion. And he thought only positive or scientific knowledge was legitimate. So as he said, only the how questions matter. Why questions have to be eliminated. And that's the method, you might say, of the modern academy, you know, that the only questions that really matter are not meaningful. But Comte also realized human beings were religious animals. And so we needed to worship. What better thing to worship than ourselves? And Comte has this phrase throughout the System of Positive Polity. He wrote only gigantic multi-volume works on positivism, on positive polity. He even wrote a catechism of the religion of humanity.
But, did he call it a catechism?
A catechism. And he was the high priest.
Of course.
And he invited the Pope and the head of the Jesuits and the Russian Tsar to watch him be crowned as the high, or ordained as the high priest of the religion of humanity in Notre Dame in 1851. So there's farcical elements to Comte's religion of humanity. And the Brazilians were the only one who took it up. The Brazilian Republic founded in 1891. Their flag, Order and Progress, it's the symbols of the international Comtean movement. So the modern Brazil was founded by adherents of the religion of humanity. Comte said, man is the grand être, the great being.
So you said you bring meaning, you bring measure out of the horizon, out of transcendence. Man is the measure of all things. Does that rule out supernatural faith of any kind?
It does.
Okay, so it's not as if we're saying God is out there. Whatever guys, but we can sort of
Comte was as hostile to religious affirmation as Marx. It was an opium. It was a distortion of reality. It was self-obfuscation. But one of the themes in my book is that while the religion of humanity as an official movement caught on only in eccentric intellectual circles and in Brazil, that for all intents and purposes, it is the animating philosophy of the modern world. Our elites essentially buy what Solzhenitsyn calls anthropocentric humanism, that man is the measure, that there is no superintending principles of justice, morality, that have their ground in either a traditional conception of natural justice or in a created order made by the creator God. So,
but you do say, taking from Vogelin, you do say, and it sort of reflects what you said a minute ago about worship, that you need worship, that Comte did provide what he called pseudo-Christian assonances.
Well, he talked a lot about love, for example. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to show that when the biblical injunction to love God and love one's neighbor with all one's heart and soul, the great imperatives, you know, the two commandments, two great commandments that Jesus puts before us, when they're severed from a theological and metaphysical and transcendental context, they can become nihilistic and antinomian and destructive of common life. You know, love becomes, we see this, I think, in many social movements today. I have students who'll tell me, unless you're in favor of transgender ideology or gay marriage, you're not loving your neighbor, because they identify love with softness, with accommodation to every expression of difference, and even with what the tradition calls sin. Love is simply accommodating others on their path, no matter how self-destructive, however contrary to the tradition or the moral law or the teachings of the church. So love shorn of its Christian context can become a destructive and nihilistic sentimentality.
If you don't go along with that conception of love, they're not going to leave you alone.
That's right. And there we see a totalitarianism lurking behind. The other thing I want to tell you about Comte and the Religion of Humanity, Comte believed nations were obsolete. He thought Europe was the avant-garde of humanity. And the way a lot of Europeans today think of themselves as the avant-garde, they have a higher consciousness than the Americans, who still believe in national self-government and sovereignty and borders, at least half the country. And Comte thought war was an anachronism. It would simply disappear. And he also had contempt for representative institutions. He thought elites, bureaucrats, a governing class imbued with the religion of humanity. That's what real democracy was. It was when the experts imbued with a higher consciousness set up a society where the real needs of human beings were addressed. So all of this sounds wonderfully contemporary.
Indeed.
But one of my arguments is that these premises have been imbibed in decisive ways by the churches themselves. And that means that a lot of what goes by the name of Christianity today, a kind of aggressive and doctrinaire egalitarianism, a silly and facile cosmopolitanism, a cult of social justice, confusing social justice with socialism, and reducing love of God and love of neighbor to a one-sided emphasis on the corporal works of mercy, sort of forgetting the interiority of the soul, forgetting the soul's relationship to God. All of this is as much humanitarianism as it is Christianity. And I even call Pope Francis, who I think is a troubling figure for those who are Orthodox Catholics, I call him a half humanitarian and a half Christian, because so many of his, I'm not talking about the crazy, ill-disciplined, off-the-cuff remarks that disturb one of my French friends, who's a very serious man, a famous man, said, every time I hear him talk, I am filled with violent despondency. Well, certainly off-the-cuff remarks do that, you know. There is no hell and all of this.
Yeah.
But so much of what he says in the name of Christianity is what Solovyev or Benson would have said is it's a falsification of the good. It's the transformation of Christianity into a kind of soft subversion of itself.
I think you have to look that the humanitarians, the secular liberals of our world, that their immediate love of Francis, the outpouring of, finally the Catholic Church has, you could sense he's one of them.
And
they have the radar. They caught him.
And they're not coming back to the faith. They admire him because somehow they sense that he's above all a progressive and a humanitarian. And by the way, think of what Francis has done with mercy. One of the attributes, God, a Christian, a Jew, believes God in some fundamental sense is our father and even our friend. But divine mercy demands repentance. It demands the turning of the soul toward God, an opening of the soul to grace. And Robert Schmemann, the great Catholic moral philosopher who just died a few weeks ago, said in response to Amoris Laetitia that Pope Francis gets way ahead of God's mercy because, you know, as Vladimir Solovyov, who I write about, the author of The Short Tale of the Antichrist, said against Tolstoy, Christ's benignity was not able to convert or convince men who had closed themselves off to the saving grace of God. Mm. Think of the two criminals on the cross with Jesus. One repents, right, and Jesus says, this day you shall be with me in paradise. The other doesn't repent, and Jesus says no such thing to him. You know, Jesus was not a magician who had this miraculous power to save all. That there has to be human cooperation with God's grace. And by the way, divine mercy doesn't mean God may have mercy on a soul, but if a man has killed three or four people, divine justice demands that he be punished. And so divine mercy can never be a substitute for the proper working of secular law, for example. And by the way, I think it's no accident that Pope Francis told the atheist Italian Marxist interviewer who doesn't take notes, you know that guy?
Yeah.
He doesn't believe in hell. And when Greg Burke, the Vatican press secretary, who's now resigned a few days ago, was asked about that, all he said is the interviewer doesn't take notes. He didn't say that the Pope denied the existence of hell. But you see a logic here. The teaching on capital punishment. It's also well known that the Pope believes life sentences are immoral, unmerciful, unjust. So there is a soft antinomian prejudice against the law, against any punishment.
How does the Catholic Church end up with a Pope who even doubts the existence of hell?
My view is if Bergoglio, if Pope Francis doesn't believe in hell, if he doesn't believe in the eschatology of the Church, if he doesn't believe in the Catholic Catechism, he ought to resign. Because the Roman Catholic to the Pope is not an Oriental potentate. He doesn't have the ability to restate Catholic teaching. That's why I think his recent remarks on capital punishment are so disturbing. If Jesus thought it was illicit, the power of the state, if St. Paul did, if Augustine did, if Pius XII did, if John Paul II did, if the Catholic Catechism did, and Pope Francis dismisses this all as simply a mistake by men who were shaped by the bad, you know, the corrupted thinking of their time, what we really have here is a humanitarian historicism where he has a higher consciousness and he can see what Jesus and Paul and Augustine and St. Thomas couldn't see. That's not the Catholic faith.
No. He can't resign because leftists never resign.
They never resign.
When they get power, and this is what it's for.
Yeah.
You don't resign. You change things.
No, that's right. That's right. And by the way, he has. I don't want to give the listener the. I have one chapter on Pope Francis. I look at his writings very carefully, and I do point out important sections where he is intelligently in continuity with his great predecessors. But I also point out this corruption of divine mercy, the silence about sin and relativism, and also a very disturbing indulgence toward left-wing tyrannies, the present Vatican diplomatic behavior towards China and the betrayal of the underground church is deeply disturbing. You know, when he landed in Cuba in 2015, Fidel was too old to greet him at the airport, but he told his dictator brother Raul that he wanted to give his expressions of deepest affection and respect to a man who had persecuted the church for 60 years. By the way, why do these people around Bergoglio think the best regimes in the world are regimes that systematically murder and persecute their co-religionists? You know, might have seen that an acolyte of Pope Francis on the Social Justice Committee in the Vatican said that Catholic social teaching is best embodied and instantiated today in the People's Republic of China. This is stunning. Stunning coming from Rome. So there's problems. But the deeper part of my book looks at a series of thinkers in the 19th century and 20th century who saw this humanitarian subversion of both Christianity and sound and decent politics. Soloviev, with his great tale of the Antichrist, Soloviev talked about a falsification of the good, where philanthropy turns against itself and becomes an instrument of the Antichrist. As if, you know, when Christ was tempted in the desert, what did Satan want him to be? He wanted him to be a liberation theologian. He wanted him to take, power. He wanted, above all, to feed the poor. And Pope Benedict, in his commentary on those passages, which I cite in chapter 1, said, notice the countries that took Satan's advice. You know, first give them bread, then we'll worry about virtue, as the Grand Inquisitor says in Dostoevsky. They all ended up not being able to feed the poor. And, you know, the agricultural disasters in every communist country, because they did not know the human person. They proceeded as if human beings did not have souls. And Soloviev saw this. Solzhenitsyn saw it in his critique of Tolstoy, who transformed Christianity into a religion of absolute non-resistance to evil, a literal pacifistic reading of the Sermon on the Mount. I talk about Orel Kolnai, a great Hungarian Catholic convert and phenomenologist who saw that the humanitarian attitude was fundamentally at odds with the Christian attitude, and that and he saw in 1944, when he wrote a great essay on the humanitarian versus the religious attitude, that things like abortion and euthanasia were around the corner. And figures were quite prophetic. They saw what precisely would happen when the humanitarian attitude and ethos crowded out the sort of capital left from the Christian past.
One of your chapters pulls up the thinker Habermas, and you talk about the post-political temptation. What is the another term here? What is the post-political temptation?
Well, you know, Habermas, he's so much better than like Badiou, the French communist who wrote speeches on the disquisitions of Mao during the Cultural Revolution, or Zizek, you know, the fashionable guy in the humanities who's a neo-communist. But Habermas is a cosmopolitan. He is an advocate of what he calls procedural constitutional patriotism. For example, the Germans would be loyal to their present constitution, but all the traditions and feelings of the German nation would be sort of severed from what German patriotic attachment means. But I look at a couple of books of Habermas where Habermas talks about the UN as a kind of symbolic expression of the, and a juridical expression of the aspiration to leave sovereignty behind. So Habermas believes that in principle, with the UN and with the European Community, the very Comtean, the avant-garde of humanity is in the process of leaving the nation behind. And he wants the nation to be left behind because he wants,
what is wrong with nations?
Well, Germans have a nation problem because Chesterton said, just because some people murder their wives and beat their children doesn't mean we should get rid of marriage or love is a bad thing. And he made an analogy with the nation. The nation in and of itself is a good thing. It's the home of common life. It's the home of a self-government. But as Roger Scruton said, the Nazis did terrible things to other peoples because their own government did terrible things to their own people. In other words, this is a pathological subversion of the nation. But I think German elites in particular, and intellectual elites in general throughout the Western world, when they hear nation, they always resort to the reductio ad Hitlerum. The nation means Hitler invading Austria, or murdering 6 million Poles, or destroying European Jewry, and therefore there's a moral imperative to leave the nation behind and adopt some form of world government or world sovereignty.
And what about just the sort of ordinary, the ordinary patriotism of people saying, this is my country.
Well,
and I love my country. Is for them, they just see a dark side to that?
I don't know if Habermas sees a terrible dark side to that, but he doesn't want to make it part of his definition of patriotism. So constitutional patriotism to him is just attachment to the legal documents of the basic law, the German Constitution of 1948, 1949. The idea that there's a strong affective dimension to patriotism. I love my country.
Mm-hmm.
It's my, you know, Lincoln said about his beau ideal of a statesman, Henry Clay, and his eulogy for Clay in 1852. Clay loved his country partly because it was his own and mainly because it was good. That's a good definition of a thoughtful patriotism. Habermas doesn't really want us to think that we should love our country too much because it's our own, you know. And he wants a sort of rational attachment to these universal forms of humanity. He's not as crazy as some, but
no.
But he he's not as hateful toward religion as some. But I don't think he really recognizes that human beings will forever be attached to concrete expressions of their humanity. And I think this, all of advanced European thought, and that also means advanced American thought, is under the pull or allure of an idea of the universal that crushes the particular. Pierre Menante, who wrote the foreword of my book, has argued repeatedly, it's only through the concrete that we have any access to the universal. Because in the political common good, we have a kind of inkling or an intimation of a higher good that can't be concretized politically, but all the values, all the virtues inherent in a well-constituted political community point to something beyond the particularity of that community.
And do they regard the periodic resurgence of populism, let's say, in response to the sort of abstract cosmopolitanism, they simply regard that as an aberration that we can educate ourselves out of?
Well, it's very simple. When European elites talk about democracy, they mean the tyranny of a democratic idea. Democratic idea has very little to do with what the people want. It has to do with the formal rules or aspirations, cosmopolitanism, secularism, the repudiation of the West as they see it is sort of uniquely culpable. Get rid of all that, and democracy then is a set of rules and regulations that allow democracy as an idea to triumph. So Pierre Menante has a beautiful expression. He says they want a crassi, they want a rule of the democratic idea without the kratos, without a people. Hmm. And so that everyone, you know, the journalists talk about the democratic deficit, but the democratic deficit is rooted in this contempt for the idea that self-governing peoples ought to decide their future.
And your ultimate point is that the Christian church cannot, however much it might seem in figures like Francis that you can blend the humanitarian with Christianity, the Christian church is going to go down. It'll deteriorate.
Yeah.
Let's just say.
By the way, as a friend of mine says, you know, Jesus does say, I'll always be with you. He doesn't tell us that the Quebec church will survive forever. He doesn't tell us the Spanish church will survive forever. He doesn't tell us the Irish church will survive forever. And he doesn't tell us the American church. The more they endorse a reductive, secularist religion of humanity and pretend it's Christianity, the less attractive authentic Christianity will be for ordinary people. And it's quite possible the Catholic Church could go the way of the Church of England. Not die, but become a fundamental irrelevance. And that's a deep concern of mine, that they literally don't know what they're doing. I make a point early in the book, the best way I think we can describe our situation today, on the campuses to be sure, but now it's bleeding over to the larger polity. You know that, Mark. We are confronting a toxic mix of limitless relativism and limitless moralism. Hmm. And I think this humanitarian spirit reinforces that.
I think a lot of conservative critics, they agree about the limitless relativism, but they forget the moralism.
Yeah.
The limitless moralism, the political correctness. And it's not just a free do whatever, be, you know, float your own boat kind of thing.
It's deeply coercive.
Deeply.
And it's also marked, and this is something it has in common with 20th century totalitarianism, or even going back to the French Revolution, with a deep and abiding ideological Manichaeism. Humanity isn't divided into two camps, the pure and the impure. And that's the invitation for totalitarian conversion, because your opponents are not misguided. They're evil.
They're evil. And we have to be purified.
They have to be purified. And, the Bolsheviks and the Jacobins use that kind of language of regeneration, of purifying the human race. And you hear a lot of that rhetoric on college campuses today. I've always gotten wonderful teaching evaluations. I think my students like me, but... In my senior seminar this year, I dealt with some tricky issues like, Islam and politics and transgenderism. And one young person wrote on the evaluations, "Are you making us so uncomfortable? You suggested that maybe there's a problem with gender ideology, or you reminded us there are honor killings. Well, we felt uncomfortable and you should have stopped." And I thought, here I am at a small Roman Catholic college, and I have students telling me to shut up.
Man, we don't ever want that student to be in a position of discretionary power over other people.
Because the self-government of the American people will suffer very badly.
Indeed. All right, well, on that, Professor Mahoney, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The book is The Idol of Our Age, How the Religion of Humanity Subverts Christianity, out with Encounter Books.
Thank you. Great fun.